This season, the Tottenham Way is sponsored by Harry's, and Harry's are the US shaving company hoping to make a big impact in the UK. And if you go to harrys.com/Tottenham, you can get your trial set for £3.95. That is usually worth £11.95. For that £3.95, you will get some shaving foam, a razor with five blades, a travel cover, and a handle in a colour of your choice. My handle is orange, Dan. What colour is yours?
It's quite racy. Mine's grey.
Grey. That's a bit bleak, but there is another third colour available. We don't know what that is, but do check it out. Go to harrys.com/Tottenham, get your trial set for £3.95. Dan and I have both got it, and we both love it because it gives you the choice of when you would like to receive your blades. Thanks very much for listening, and enjoy the pod.
No.
We were talking just before we started recording about it. What is it?
It's a guava flavoured IPA.
What is guava?
It's a fruit.
Okay, what type? I'm not very cultured like you.
That's really uncultured.
Is it?
Not knowing what. Well, maybe I'm just being a bit of a posho. You've got to know what a guava is.
I really don't.
It's like a tropical fruit. I would say it's kind of in the mango family.
Right, okay.
Maybe? Is that fair?
In a beer, though.
In a beer, not good. There's literally bits of guava floating
in the
bottom of
the drink.
If
I had to describe the beer in visual terms, I'd say it looks slightly like canal water.
Yeah. Brown, but...
browny orange.
Yeah. Not like cider, just very unappealing.
And like, with the consistency of a smoothie.
So there's not a lot going for it, really, is there? But enjoy that as the pod goes along. The other voice you can hear is Liam Toomey. I think it's safe to say you're a Tottenham Way regular now.
Pretty experienced.
Yes, I'd say so. You've been on pre and post Chelsea Spurs games before. This one's quite unique.
I don't have to be the comforter.
You have, to be fair, you have been very, very magnanimous when you've in victory. We've won a couple as well, I think, in the time that you've...
The January game last season.
Yes, the Dele Alli two goals as well. Fair's fair. We'll try and do the same. However, I mean, this is the first time in 28 years we managed it. It might be another 28 years before we do it again, so I can't promise it's going to last the full hour, but we'll see how we go. Before we go into the game, I want to talk about your new bromance, Liam, with William Shatner.
Yeah.
Not really a sentence I thought I'd... I mean, I never thought I'd say we'd beaten Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, but I really didn't expect to be sitting here saying that one of our guests has been in a Twitter conversation, a quote off,
Maybe it's like a harbinger of the apocalypse or something. It was so surreal. I mean the Shatner interaction rather than the result.
I'd say the two combined.
I think you've seen two of the horsemen.
Yeah,
it was
bizarre. I was in the Stamford Bridge press room. It was actually towards the end of Pochettino's press conference, and I always have half an eye on Twitter when the managers are speaking. Usually I'm tweeting quotes as well, but I randomly saw that Captain Kirk of all people had congratulated Spurs, the Spurs, as he called them, on their victory over the Blues. And so I did a quote tweet, basically going, what? Because I've never had any inkling that William Shatner has any kind of Sacre allegiance at all. And I think most people took from his original tweet that he might have had a soft spot for Spurs. But then he replied to me with the kind of tone of a Chelsea fan saying that
that he is a Chelsea fan or a fan.
A magnanimous Chelsea fan.
I mean, I have
a man after your own heart.
He's always ploughed his own furrow, hasn't he? William Shatner. I mean, I've got no excuse now but to try and set up an interview.
Yeah.
I think that's the only move I have left.
Oh, have you mentioned that to the desk?
It wasn't in my weekly pitch, but.
Dan, have you ever had any sci-fi stars tweet you?
No.
That's a shame. There is somebody...
that felt really harsh.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It didn't mean to come across that way.
I don't know who the best person who's ever tweeted me is.
Me.
I mean, apart from you, Tom. That goes without saying.
We don't tweet anymore. We don't speak. Well, you think on that.
I will think on that. And let you know by the end of the pod. Everyone.
Your lumpy tropical beer. Mm. Yes. So let's go straight into it. 28 years. February 1990 was the last time we beat Chelsea at Stamford Bridge.
I was just over a year old.
Well, I was going to say, Dan, you must have been what? Two.
About to turn two.
I was three, or nearly about to turn three. Eight of our first 11 who started yesterday. On Sunday. Hadn't been born, the three that had, Dan?
Lloris, Dembele, Vertonghen.
Correct. All under 4 years old. So, I mean, it just shows you how long it's been and how many cycles of players we've had since we last won there. Start with you, Liam. Were you surprised that it happened now when you consider the cycles that Chelsea have been in that time and the sort of crossing paths of Spurs and Chelsea? Because it's not like you've... It's not like the Arsenal thing where we hadn't finished above them in such a long time where they were consistently better than us, apart from the odd results, say. But, we've crossed paths and crossed trajectories quite a lot. So, considering it was a game that you needed to win, really needed to win, and you were at home and you had all this history behind you, is it surprising that it happened on Sunday?
No. It's my first thought, really. It was slightly surprising in the manner that the hoodoo was ended with Harry Kane, largely superfluous on the bench coming on, really, as just sort of a show of strength from Spurs in the second half, wasn't needed to do anything. But in terms of where the two clubs are at right now, I wasn't hugely surprised. Chelsea have won prior to this, they won 6 of 19 games in 2018, and the best team they've beaten was Leicester in extra time in the FA Cup. Mm. So they've not shown since Christmas an ability to beat good teams, and there have been some moments along the way, like the positive start against Arsenal in the League Cup semi away from home, the positive start at Old Trafford where they took the lead as well. But there's a pattern emerging in these big games with Chelsea where they seem to make a good start, get into a position of advantage, and then unlike last season, they just let the game drift away from them. And that's partly the players on the pitch, and it's also partly Conte, who, again, yesterday just didn't really react when, we can talk about the changes Spurs made, but just didn't really react to what Spurs are doing. And
he's half out the door, isn't he, Conte?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even more than that. He's just sort of a foot dangling still.
Yeah, and
Stamford Bridge.
Gianluca Vialli's comments post-match were particularly telling, because not only is he a former teammate of Conte, for him to say Conte can't wait to leave Chelsea is pretty unambiguous, and they're pretty close friends as well. He was one of the people that Conte spoke to when he first came to London, so he's in a position of knowledge on that one.
Mm. Dan, in terms of Spurs, we can talk about Chelsea, and they are in a bit of a rut at the moment. They look a very disinterested team from sort of top to bottom. But Spurs still had to go out there and win it from a losing position as well, which when you consider what we, a couple of years ago, in the Leicester title season when we went to Stamford Bridge 2-0 up at half-time and completely collapsed and imploded... That's an extra step, isn't it? And that's a real hurdle that we've got over, not just the 28 years, it could have been 10 years at Stamford Bridge. It's Chelsea and it's a big rival, and we do seem to sort of collapse when we go there. So significant for you in more than just the length of time?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. The manner of the win was definitely significant. And as Liam said, I think while I'm not surprised that Spurs did it this season, I did feel like the circumstances of the game coming after the international break as well, maybe if it had been before the break and Spurs had all that momentum, it would have felt a bit less surprising. But you never really know what to think when everyone comes back after a couple of weeks, and Spurs actually have history of kind of losing a bit of rhythm after the international break. They certainly did it on a couple of occasions last season. So yeah, I thought it was particularly encouraging to see Spurs come from a goal down, definitely.
It's the monkey off the back, isn't it, as well? We can go... It's a bit like the Arsenal thing as well. That pressure is suddenly not necessarily there going forward now.
Yeah, I mean, Liam and I did a Facebook Live for ESPN before the game, and I said it was it's a considerable gorilla of a monkey on Spurs back. You know, it's such a big thing, and it does feel like as a club, even though you only go to Stamford Bridge normally once a season, it does still feel like that's just a thing sort of hanging over the club, and has been for a while. And certainly, given the club's ambitions, you know, to win trophies, to win the Premier League title, I feel like they have to get over that kind of thing before they can take that step. You know, it was never like Man U were winning all these titles under Ferguson, but oh, they hadn't won at wherever for 28 years. You know, clubs don't.
Liverpool, exactly.
Clubs don't tend to win things. Clubs who have that kind of record in any kind of game don't tend to be clubs that win things. It just felt like something the Spurs had to get over, and now they have. You know, you might say that the final monkey is kind of winning a trophy. I feel like I'm veering into Roy Hodgson territory. I'm getting worried. But you might say the final monkey is winning a trophy, but you know, I feel like there's no shackles on Spurs anymore to do that. You know, there's no history that's kind of against them in that quest anymore.
And we seem to have developed that this season as well. You look at Arsenal away we lost, United away we lost, and then City away we lost all before Christmas. And then since the turn of the year, we went to Anfield and we sort of clawed our way back to a 2-2. And now we've gone and won at Stamford Bridge. And it feels like there's been that steady progression, even in a short term as well there. Because we still said when we went to the Emirates and went to Old Trafford and kind of meekly turned up and went through the motions and eventually lost, that was still a massive hurdle for us. But it's kind of that teaching you how to win without winning anything. There's no silver pot for winning.
I think if you look at the bigger picture, at the beginning of February, Spurs had that run of United, Liverpool, Arsenal, and then we knew Chelsea were on the horizon with City, and it really did look like make or break. And the away form of the Big Six was so bad at that point, and Pochettino still had this question mark about his ability to get it right in the biggest games. The players still have that question mark over their ability to cope with pressure and deliver on the bigger stages. And Spurs have come through those games so well. And yes, Juventus, it was a bit of a blip in amongst all that. But yeah, it's really impressive to look at where Spurs are now, given the run of games they've had since the turn of the year.
Yeah, I agree. Eriksen's goal, which I feel like is a good place to start, even though I look at Ali's first goal and I actually kind of prefer it, I think, because it was everything about it was incredible.
I prefer Ali's goal.
I think so, but he's nothing like a screamer off the bar, is it? Because it just touched the bar on the way through Eriksen. We've got a bit of a history at Stamford Bridge of scoring these, particularly in the recent years. Sandro did it under Redknapp, Adebayor under AVB, Eriksen did it last season, obviously his goal at Weekend as well. It's been a bit sort of style over substance in that sense, I suppose. But do you put goalkeeper, it was Caballero, wasn't it, in goal? Do you put him at fault at all for that? Because it's been a bit of a debate. You know, if De Gea was in goal, he would have saved it, or is it good enough that?
Well, I don't think so. You know. I don't think so. I think sometimes we can overthink these things a little bit. I think the most he could have done was to look better while conceding.
He did fall over, you know, didn't he?
The way he sort of fell limply to the floor and looked every day of a 36-year-old didn't do him any favours. But Chelsea's mistake was giving Eriksen that much space 25 yards out, because you know he's one of the best strikers of a ball with either foot from that range probably in the world right now. Him and De Bruyne are certainly in, I would say, like the top five.
And he'd had two in the 10 minutes beforehand,
exactly,
as well. And
yeah,
in the last game against Swansea, he scored at least one screamer from the edge of the area. I think he might have got two as well. So he's working his way into this sort of form, isn't he? He's got his eye in.
I mean, the warning signs were there for Chelsea, not just from the game last year and not just from Tottenham's recent games, but within that game itself. Early on, it looked like Eriksen was trying to do what Tottenham had done to Chelsea last year and drift into that crossing position on the right, and Ali try and peel into the space between Azpilicueta and Moses, which, you know, has been very effective for Spurs, and that weakness is still there. But after a little while, about 20-25 minutes into the game, he stopped doing that, and Eriksen moved centrally, and every time, because Chelsea were defending so deep and they weren't giving up too many shots in quality positions, but they were leaving that space. Eriksen's always, you know, a smart enough player to recognise that, and every single time he got the ball in that position, he had a long think about whether he wanted to shoot. And in that situation, it just opened up perfectly for him. Chelsea gave him far too much space. I think Fabregas in a two-man midfield certainly doesn't help in that regard, because contrary to the legend he's built up over the last 18 months, Kante can't actually be everywhere and press everyone at the same time. But, you know, Chelsea made mistakes in that game, but Tottenham pounced upon them brilliantly, and that was the case with the first goal and with the second goal.
An interesting debate on Eriksen, because he did appear to move positions in the first half, as Liam says, and I've seen an interesting discussion online about whether that was Pochettino or whether Eriksen, as a very intelligent player who manipulates space very well, decided that himself and just dropped back into that pocket. And then obviously Spurs kind of stuck with a variation of that in the second half and moved Son to the right wing and moved Lamela up front, and Pochettino took a lot of credit, but it felt like maybe Eriksen just decided that was what he was going to do at some point in the first half.
It's not uncommon for us to see Eriksen do that and drop into basically become a three-man midfield, but usually that's with Kane up front. My point is
whether it was Poch saying that's what you need to do, or whether Eriksen just looking for space on the pitch.
I would argue it's Poch, having seen it quite a few times.
It certainly became more formalised after half time. In terms of Tottenham went more to sort of an out-and-out three up front with Eriksen behind, in just hogging that central area, whereas in the first half it was a little bit more fluid, people switching over. And Ali started making those out-to-in runs, didn't he, which led to the second goal as well.
Eriksen and Ali enjoyed himself against Chelsea, it seems. You know, I don't think Kane scored since the 5-3. No, he scored in the cup semi.
And in the 2-2.
So he has scored. But
got a couple.
Damn it! I really thought about this stat earlier as well, because I thought this was good and I've ruined it.
It's a good stat.
It is a good stat. Thanks. Eight of the last 9 goals we've scored against Chelsea have involved Ali and or Eriksen. So there's been a lot of times when they've combined. Mentioned the 2 goals at White Hart Lane last season, the cup semi-final as well, which was almost an identical goal in the sort of delivery of Eriksen. Brian McPherson on Twitter asked, what is your favourite Ali against Chelsea goal? Dyer assist from Sunday or one of the 3 goals from Eriksen crosses last season?
I think Dyer assist.
Really?
On Sunday. Yeah, I really, really like that goal.
Yeah.
It was just the first touch and the way he kind of flowed onto it after that first touch and didn't really break stride, and it all seems almost like one movement.
It was very confident, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just instinctive, wasn't it? And I think it just showed you that natural ability that Ali has. And it obviously felt significant, because there's been all this stuff about him having a bad season and being off form, which I massively dispute, but it felt like a fuck you to his critics. And so, given the circumstances and the quality, I think it's my favourite.
Do you think it's unfair what Ali's been getting, certainly in the last couple of weeks, but in broader terms this season? Everyone says that he has had a dip, and Dan, you say you disagree there, but we have said that on this pod this season. We've said that we feel like Ali's had that inevitable drop. We've not necessarily criticised him for it, but it's something we've pointed out.
Yeah, I suppose. It's more, for me, it's more the way that him not playing for England has been taken to some kind of tremendously significant gesture on Southgate's part.
Like a Mourinho-esque disciplinary move.
Exactly. Like, he limped off at Bournemouth before the international break. And then I think just before the international break, Poch said, I can't remember if he played at Swansea. Do you remember?
Who?
Fally played at Swansea.
No, I think he came on. He came on for
he
the
came
last
on. So he was. Exactly. So he was rested at Swansea. And I think Poch said, you know, he's a bit fatigued, he's struggling a bit, he had a muscle strain at Bournemouth, I think. So I was surprised he wasn't withdrawn from the squad, actually. I was thinking he might be. So really, it didn't surprise me that he didn't play all that much for England. I think those 2 games were obviously quite experimental, hence Kyle Walker at centre-half. And I don't think it was all that significant from Southgate, although it seems like maybe he people that went to those games got briefed that Southgate was a bit unhappy with Ali for giggling on the bench or whatever, but that also seemed like a storm in a teacup. And, you know, it just suddenly became like, the narrative suddenly became, oh, Ali's having this really troubled season. Oh, Lingard's better. Oh, he's fighting for his World Cup place. And that all just seemed very unfair when actually his numbers for goals and assists, even before Chelsea, were very good. He hadn't scored as many as last year, but assisted a lot more. I think he's been involved, even if he hasn't been at the centre of everything good Spurs have done, which is normally Eriksen or Kane or this season's Son. So I just felt the whole thing was blown out of proportion.
In fairness, we watch him every single week. So Liam, you would be able to come at this from a what we'd call an outside point of view. How do you think Ali's done this season? Was Sunday any sort of surprise to hit, see him explode with those two goals?
Well, disclaimer, Lingard's not better. No. And it's not particularly close. I do watch him less frequently than you guys, but even when I was watching him last season, I always felt with Ali that he's not the kind of player whose influence you feel in every moment of a game. He's not like Eriksen. He's not at the centre of all the play, and that, you know, it's mainly to do with the position he plays. But he's a player of moments, and maybe at the start of the season he had fewer of those moments, which allowed that narrative to develop, especially when you've got all the off-field talk about agents and Real Madrid and all this stuff. I think it all adds up to create a story which then maybe obscures the fact that the reality can change. You know, a season's a long time, and I wasn't surprised to see him play as well as he did at the weekend. He's always struck me as a big game player. One of the things I like most about him is that he's got that edge. He's a bit of a bastard, and you want that. He's got it in order to not only believe that you can influence and decide games with that many good players on the pitch, but then actually go out and do it. You need arrogance, a good kind of arrogance. You know, Kane has it and displays it in a different way. Ali's maybe a little bit more brash about it on the pitch, but I really like that about him, and the whole, you know, sort of cupping his ear to the Chelsea fans and stuff. Yeah, he could. If he'd have turned left instead of right after that second goal, he would have been celebrating in front of the Spurs fans. But he made a conscious decision to go over to the Chelsea part of the shed end, and I like that about him. I think every club needs that.
He thrives on it.
Yeah,
being
you said
disliked.
It before. Yeah.
I think it's spurs him on. He enjoys being the pantomime villain, and he probably plays better for it. So bring on the boots.
Yeah, interesting. The four that started up front as well. We seem to have two bastards and two really kind of, I don't know what, Son, I wouldn't call him that sort of soft player, but he's not got that edge to him, has he? He's just sort of pure incisiveness. You look at the third goal and Eriksen's touch for that, I think that's underrated as well. In the midst of Eriksen's goal and Ali's first, that touch by Eriksen
around the corner,
incredible.
Yeah.
They do seem to just really turn it on, but it definitely worth pointing out the contribution of Son and Lamella certainly. Because fair play, I've been quite critical of him since he's come back from injury. I've been questioning where his place in the squad is. I'm still not fully convinced. Well, yeah, I bet you've said, you know, a few times that you feel like that's the role that he can play, and he did the exact role that you've said he could do in his two best performances this season, which have been Juventus away and Chelsea away.
Yeah, I mean, I made the Park Ji-sung comparison a few weeks ago before the Juventus second leg, that he's the kind of player you do want in the big games, because he will just do what's asked of him. He will follow orders, he will provide intensity, he will give absolutely everything. And they all sound a bit kind of proper football man cliches, but they are really important qualities, and yeah, that's what he can do. I think
should have probably been at least booked.
He showcased the good bastard streak himself at Stamford Bridge. He wasn't the most popular man there, but I mean, he did have a really good game. Mainly, actually, what he did without the ball, really. He was a big part of the way Tottenham pressed Chelsea into mistakes in both halves.
That's not unusual for his role. But we have him as now. He's never going to be the numbers.
He's never
going to
score 20 goals a season like Son, Ali and Kane are capable of. But he adds something different, and mentioning no names at all, but I feel like some of his detractors have previously said, oh, pressing isn't a real quality or movement isn't a real quality. But you see on Sunday how important those qualities can be and how important they are, especially in the big games.
Yeah, I think oddly I'd rather see him play against Chelsea away than Huddersfield at home.
Absolutely. For me, absolutely. When you probably don't need that extra level of tactical discipline.
Mm. Yes, it's a weird one, isn't it?
Just one final thing. The thing that struck me watching the game from the sidelines, and this may or may not have struck you guys a while ago, but I mean, more an indication of where both clubs are right now, but Tottenham have better top line talent than Chelsea. Tottenham's three best players are better than Chelsea's three best players.
Who would you say are Chelsea's three best players? Hazard?
Hazard, Kante.
Willian?
On form, yes, but probably not. I'd say Azpilicueta, actually, probably. I mean, Kante would get into that Spurs team. Hazard, when he's on form, although he's not, he didn't show up at the weekend, and he's faded at a really bad time of the season for Chelsea. But you look at, I mean, Eriksen's been out of his mind for quite a while now, and I think actually deserves more consideration on the fringes of the Player of the Year conversation. Obviously, it's going to be one of two, either De Bruyne or Salah, but Eriksen definitely deserves a mention because he's been that good. Kane, you've got the best striker in the world in your team. And I think, you know, Ali as well, I think, is such a special talent at such a young age. I know a lot of people scoffed when Pochettino said he was the best 21-year-old in the world, but, I mean, if he isn't...
Name another.
There aren't many ahead of him.
Yeah, so it's him or Sane.
Yeah, and they're two very, very different players as well. It sort of seems weird to...
and I think they're both well on track to be proper superstars.
Mm. Yeah, at Real Madrid. I hesitate to... It was such a positive thing, of course, in so many ways, and I kind of hesitate to ask the question, but the first goal was a bit disappointing to concede. There's been some questions, again, from mainly people on Twitter about Lloris, and his... I mean, it wasn't good. He didn't cover himself in glory in that. There's a couple of people that suggested, I think it was David Priest, who said that if he didn't come for it, the quality of the header was good enough to beat him anyway. But it just, I don't think he puts off Sanchez if he doesn't come for it. I think Sanchez probably gets a better jump on it.
I don't think
it just
really
feels like a bit of a...
What if this or what if that? Yeah, it was a mistake from Lloris.
So it's his fourth this season, apparently, in the league. He's the third highest. He's behind Cech and Begovic, who you both consider to be having poor seasons. I think Cech's made 7, Begovic 6. Okay, he's not pushing them hard for that, and you wouldn't expect him to beat either of them.
What's this? Errors leading to goals?
Yes, sorry, yeah. Errors leading to goals. But, I mean, the first Chelsea game of the season... The second Alonso's goal, the second one that won it, went through it. And you do look at these big games, if you like. Juventus, I felt like he could have done more in those first few minutes when he let Higuain volley in from the edge. There's this narrative, again, to use the word, that he does seem to fail in these big games or have his worst moments in the big games. Do you think it's a problem? I know it's a big discussion of who's better, but he's 31 now? He's pushing 31, I think. I mean, his reaction times are only kind of going to get worse, aren't they? And that's what he relies on. Do you think there's any chance that we're going to sort of see him in the next couple of seasons really fade? Because he was such a high level at such a young age, and that's never really that good a sign, I don't think, for any footballer, regardless of position.
I think goalkeepers can peak at around 32, 33. So I don't think... Just because he's in his 30s now, I don't think it necessarily means.
Depending on what sort of goalkeeper you are, though, that's
true. But I don't think because he's that age, it means that he's on the way down or he's entering a decline. Yeah, I'm always a big defender of Lloris. I think he's a really, really important part of the way Spurs want to play, and I think arguably, well, in fact, definitely the only player who's a class above him doing what he does is Edison, who has basically revolutionised goalkeeping. His distribution is just phenomenal, and Lloris isn't there at all, and he does make mistakes with his distribution, but he's a very important part of the way Pochettino wants Tottenham to play. I've said this before, and I think he's always been a kind of high risk goalkeeper. He was, when he came to the Premier League, he was billed as like this original sweeper keeper. He would play very much on the edge of his box.
Yeah.
He was perfectly suited for the high line. He would race out and get to the ball ahead of attackers, and that's what he did. And I think when you've got a keeper that plays a kind of risky game, he is going to make mistakes. And I think in a way, he's a kind of high risk, high reward option. And I think he does make errors. That's part of his game. But then I think everything he brings in terms of experience, you know, Pochettino has said he's more or less part of the coaching staff. Mm. In terms of the way he plays.
He's captain.
Yeah, the captain. Yeah. I think everything he brings outweighs those errors that he does make, and there's no denying that he makes them.
Fair enough. All right, we'll move on because I don't think.
To make a discussion, but that's.
But I don't think we should be focusing on something like that. I do think it's a bit unfair. It's just this is two Chelsea games in a row that he's done this.
The one thing I'd say about that Morata goal is that you, as any goalkeeper, you can't necessarily legislate for a pinpoint Victor Moses cross. Having watched him all season, when he pulls his foot back, it's like buying a lottery ticket.
Fair.
And I like Moses as a player, good. There was a confluence of events, a perfect storm of events came together for that goal.
Right. It's a good place to move on, I think, because I do think we need to speak a little bit about Chelsea. You know, with you here, we're 8 points clear of you now. I think we've both got a game in hand on Liverpool. Mm. I think, but. Both on 31 games, we're 8 points ahead now. Clearly, or an evidently disinterested Chelsea, disinterested Conte. We've only got Man City left to play of the top seven as well, and that's at home. They could have the title wrapped up. There's a lot of factors that seem to be going in our favour. Do you feel it's done? First question. And also, why? What's happened? Why did Chelsea go through this yearly cycle of being fantastic and unstoppable? And then just completely imploding, because it's not like you haven't challenged in the two seasons after you've won the last two titles. You have, you've not even been close, and you've missed out on Champions League both those years. So considering you've had that bad season this season, should Spurs be worried next season when you think new stadium, of the other three teams are likely to improve yet again, Liverpool, Man City, Man United. So should we be worried about Chelsea's next season, or is this a pattern that might be emerging?
Well, there's a lot there. First thing is, it is done. Top four is done. Whenever you're at a stage where the points gap, the number of points is bigger than the number of games left, it's generally done. And or more importantly, Chelsea feel it's done. So you're not going to rely on them to win all seven of their last games, which is what they need to do anyway. I think now the only time you'll probably see anything like what this Chelsea team can do is in the FA Cup.
Great. Damn it.
Well, yes. I mean, they have to get past Southampton, which I know Southampton are no great shakes at the moment, but neither are Chelsea, so we'll see how that goes. As to the wider point, I think that it's never one thing, and I'm a little bit wary of lumping it into the same pattern as what happened with Mourinho, because what happened with Mourinho was exceptional even by these standards. You know, he left Chelsea in 16th. Mm. Although, I mean, having said that, if the Premier League began on New Year's Day, Chelsea would be 15th. So, you know, this second half of the season hasn't been a universe away from that. It's interesting. I think it's pretty well established at this stage that there's a mental flakiness to this team. I wouldn't call it a weakness, because you can't win two titles in 3 years being mentally weak. Mm. But they do seem to be sort of slaves to momentum. They can get swept up in things, but when things are going wrong, there aren't too many players in that team that will necessarily grab it by the scruff of the neck and change it. When Eden Hazard is your attacking leader, you know, by nature he's not that kind of personality. So that's why Diego Costa, losing him has been so huge, because you've brought in a guy in Alvaro Morata who just doesn't have that personality. Mm. That's his biggest problem.
Not a bastard.
He's not assertive enough. You know, he's big and strong enough to, in theory, be a world class target man. But his biggest problem at the moment is between his ears, and we don't know whether he'll be able to sort that out. Chelsea were always going to struggle, having lost one of the top five pure strikers in the world, because that system last season that helped win them the league was partly predicated on him just being able to bustle through two or three defenders and create something for himself. Even when Morata plays well, he's not a guy that creates chances for himself. He needs the system to work. And the other thing is that, you know, this has been actually building for a long time. I think Conte swam against the tide winning the league last year, because if you look at the recruitment Chelsea have made in the last few windows, it's been squad players. They've been building around the core that they've already got rather than adding top-line talent, which, you know, Tottenham have been developing top-line talent. The Manchester United club, the Manchester clubs have been adding top-line talent.
We sat here a year ago before the FA Cup semi, and you said it's this game, it was a preview, it was for the Chelsea Spurs semi, and you said there, this is a game between two of the best coaches in the league. And this was at a time Mourinho was still kicking about, Guardiola was in their Klopp as well. You know, all three of those are ahead of Spurs and Chelsea at the moment as well. So you can understand the Spurs drop off when you look at Wembley, but I mean, how it can't just be the Champions League, surely. Conte is still a good manager. There must be some stuff rumbling behind the scenes.
Well, I still think that's true. If Chelsea, well, Conte will leave at the end of the season, and Chelsea will struggle to find a better coach than him.
Who do you think it will be? Because that could...
It's still a little bit early to say, but, I mean, you know, the names that have been mentioned, Luis Enrique, Thomas Tuchel, I think not having to pay compensation for a manager is quite a big factor for Chelsea. They don't really want to have to pay Conte off. So if a club comes in for him, that would do everyone a favour. But I don't think either of those are a sure bet to be better than Conte, given what he's achieved. But he hasn't done himself a huge number of favours with the way he's acted this season. I don't think it's any coincidence that he ramped up his sort of rhetoric to apply pressure on the board to make signings in January, and Chelsea's form dropped off a cliff. You know, I don't necessarily think it's a direct cause and effect, but I think, you know, it has an impact. When you keep talking down the quality of the players that you have, and you keep insisting that no one can do any better, neither you nor the players, even as you're losing back-to-back games against Bournemouth and Watford, which is what really killed their top four charge, then you're kind of living in a fantasy land, I think. And for a while, it's just felt like Conte's been more interested in crafting the narrative of his own departure than actually trying to maximise what he still has. Obviously, it's not the job he hoped he'd have this season, which was retaining the league and going deep into the Champions League. But you have a duty to do the job you've got, and I don't think he's necessarily done that in the last couple of months, which is something Chelsea experienced with Mourinho as well, although Mourinho went much further than Conte did.
Yeah, James Ollie did a good piece in the Standard a few weeks ago where he said it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because Conte's been saying over and over again these players aren't good enough, and then the players aren't good enough. And I agree with you in the respect that you can't be sending out that message repeatedly, or eventually players pick up on it. And
last season was so much about him making Moses and Alonso and these players that aren't great. You know,
Costa as well. You know, Matic went, Terry went,
Louise has been sidelined.
All those leaders, the spine of the team feels like it's been ripped away, really, with the exception of Kante, who's still in there. So it does just feel, I mean, Cahill's not getting in the team now.
I think that was coming for a while. But yeah, in terms of personalities
and leaders, it feels like a very different Chelsea now.
To follow on from that, just to finish up on Chelsea, Chelsea Spurs is a potential and, let's say, realistic cup final. More so on Chelsea's side than Spurs's, but certainly is a realistic cup final. Do you think this result and everything that Liam's just said there about the more immediate problems with Chelsea, do you think that this result has any bearing or any significance in terms of a realistic cup final against Chelsea? Do you think that they're going to be coming out looking for revenge? Conte's going to be thinking, you know, last chance to really look at my legacy at Chelsea for 2 years and say I won a trophy against one of their big rivals? Or is this a mental block that we've got over and could really take it to them in a cup final?
Well, I think the latter more than the former. I think it's more likely that Conte and the players are going to be really fired up for one last hurrah, knowing the season's been a complete failure, thinking, you know, we've got one game now, should they get to the final, where they can completely redeem the season in the eyes of the fans, for themselves, by beating, you know, probably their biggest rival in a cup final, and the pain they would inflict on Spurs, given how significant this trophy hunt has become, and given the media narrative and around Spurs if they were to lose an FA Cup final. I think that would worry me more than them thinking, oh, we need to revenge that defeat at Stamford Bridge. Although Liam made a good point on our Facebook Live that I'll let him expand on, where you said Spurs need to hurt Chelsea for the rivalry to go up a level. Now Spurs presumably have hurt Chelsea and knocked them out of the top four. So it does feel like that, as you said, that there's maybe an extra level of intenseness to that rivalry, which has kind of been simmering away nicely now for the last 3 or 4 years and is arguably kind of the game with the most animosity in the Premier League, possibly.
Yeah, fair. I think that is fair.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the pain's all been one-sided in recent years. It's always been Chelsea ruining Tottenham's party in one way or the other. So by ending the Stamford Bridge hoodoo, by ending Chelsea's top four hopes, which actually is a tangible blow to Chelsea on and off the pitch, I think that should actually create the conditions needed for a potentially classic cup final, I think, if they both get there, because there needs to be wounds on both sides, and there needs to be a sense of vulnerability on both sides for it to really
thinking about it
jump
there's
up a notch.
So many narratives there, isn't there? Spurs finishing at Wembley, Spurs Chelsea, Conte's last game, we need a trophy.
possibly
Hazard's last game for Chelsea. You know what I mean?
We'd have to do a Facebook Live every day for that one.
Yeah, I think I'm not 100% sure I'll survive that week.
But it would be just ramped up so much that Spurs are finally going to get this trophy under Pochettino that they really need as a signpost of progress, and they need this to go up a level and win the title next year, and then Chelsea just come to Wembley.
Or Southampton, Pochettino's old team turn up and steamroller us and already relegate
Southampton. We've got to get past trophy specialist Mourinho.
Well, absolutely, but it's certainly worth talking about, isn't it?
Yeah,
just before we started recording, we had Dan. Don't go anywhere. Okay, Dan.
I'm here, I'm back here.
We had the financial reports for 16-17 published, didn't we, by Spurs, very low key, sort of just a very quick tweet with nothing very special alongside it. Well, I suppose it wouldn't be necessary with an annual review, but some talking points, I think. The main one probably being I don't know if this has been confirmed necessarily, but the suspicion is that the person or the director at Spurs who's on £6 million, just over £6 million a year, is obviously Daniel Levy.
It must be.
Well, you'd think so, unless it's someone who's doing really incredible work.
Paul Mitchell, his payoff.
Yeah, yeah. So
Levy's salary appears to have gone up from 2.8 million in the season before last to 6 million, which is obviously a rise of 3.2 million, over 50%. So that appears to be the big talking point from the financial results, aside from the fact that Spurs have also recorded record revenue, which is obviously something to celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the talking point probably there is, so Levy is certainly, you would say, considered the best chairman in the league.
He's certainly the best paid chairman in the league.
Well, yeah, of course.
But you'd argue, more than double.
You would argue
apparently
that in terms of running a football club, okay, you can point to the success and we can point to the trophies and things, but progression, sustainability and the way that we run our club and the things that we're doing off the pitch as well as on at the moment. We're not building a new stadium from 14th in the league with these aspirations of breaking the top six. You know, we're in a position of strength. So there's certainly enough there that you would say Levy's earning should be the best paid in the league, certainly.
Yeah.
I think as just to come from a fan point of view, we have an ongoing situation with one of Spurs' players in Toby Alderweireld. And this is a guy who, by all reports, wants 120, 130 grand a week.
I think the latest, it was at least 150 about a month ago.
Oh, sorry.
The latest reports say more like 180.
That's what he wants, and we've offered 130, say, or 120, 130 by some accounts. So we've got a guy, the figurehead of the club, the big guy at the club, is giving himself a 3x pay rise. 2 million to 6 million. That's
2.8, so about double.
All right, yeah. Between two and three times.
Let's be fair on the old boy. Yeah.
And then we've got...
I see where you're going here,
wants
yeah.
a similar percentage, I would say. Almost as...
Adamo's on £50,000 a week now, so he wants...
Give or take. He's got two to three times, I'd say.
He wants at least triple. But anyway, I see what you mean. Levy's salary hike, seems a bit incongruous with the way that he plays hardball with leading players that want a big salary hike. So I do take that point entirely. I do think that if, as you said, if there's any chairman in the Premier League that deserves to be the best paid, it is probably Daniel Levy for what he's achieved over the last 7 or 8 years, in particular, building the training grounds, building the new stadium, building the player lodge, which we found out today is going to be ready in May, and Brazil are going to be the first visitors before the World Cup. So he's achieved a hell of a lot, and not to mention the improvement on the pitch, and obviously last season's record high Premier League finish of second. And it does feel difficult to justify when you consider the way the club treats players who want a lot of money. Alvarez looks like he probably will be frozen out for the remainder of the season for not signing the contract. However, I don't think it's Levy kind of sitting in the boardroom saying, listen lads, it's been a tough year, I'm going to more than double my salary. I think it's more likely that, as with all the leading figures at the club, including Pochettino, including Kane, he has a lot of bonuses in his contract that say if you achieve certain things, you get X, Y, or Z.
I would also argue that if Levy had the equivalent of a dodgy knee, or a whatever the chairman's equivalent of a dodgy knee is, I don't know.
Oh, you're referring to Toby?
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like there is logic in not paying Toby that amount and cashing.
I mean, it's completely different. It's so different. I really don't think you can fairly make a direct comparison between a player and the chairman. I do see how it could potentially look bad, but I think it's more likely that Levy has something in his contract saying, you know, if you achieve revenues of over 300 million, you get X, or if you achieve record revenues for the club, you get Y. And he has, and the bonuses have kicked in, and he's got a big hike in salary. Possibly he shouldn't have had such a big load of clauses in his contract, but that's the way it is. And I do think, you know, if anyone... chairman in the Premier League deserves it, it's Levy.
It's certainly true that I think part of the wider problem in football is that we always report salaries, whether it's players or staff or anyone higher than that, as lump sums, and it very rarely is, almost never is, just because it's easier for us to do, and a lot of the time we don't even have all the information, so we're reporting only what we know. But what interests me about this is more that it's not really the question of whether Levy deserves to be paid that much. I mean, the market dictates, really, and success dictates what you're paid, and he's done a very good job at Tottenham the last few years. But what's interesting is the perception, because in football, perception often becomes reality and impacts your job. And given that he does seem to be, at least from the outside, so hands-on in the way that, you know, Tottenham spend their pennies on the football side with individual contracts and the way they're structured. If he's in a meeting with any agent worth their salt and they've seen these stories and they say, well, look, you got 50% pay rise last year, we're asking for something similar. What's his response to that? You know, what's his go-to? And I think that's obviously the wage thing generally is a key question for Spurs moving forward, because on the pitch they don't have too many issues beyond just keeping this group together and adding little bits and pieces around the edges. The core is good enough to win major trophies over the next few years, but can they sort of stave off the sort of relentless nature of football finances long enough to actually win the trophies this team kind of deserves to win?
And look, one final point is that Levy wasn't the only one. I think salaries and bonuses increased from 88 million to 112 million. So it's about 24 million quid in total, that extra that's being paid to staff. And it's not going to be, you know, the tea lady. That's going to mean players. And I think Alderweireld's an exception, along with, I think, Lamella, in that he didn't sign a new contract in that period. And almost every other member of the first team squad did. If you remember the flurry of contracts, that this is the year we're talking about. So, you know, guys like Kane would have gone up considerably. Ali would have gone up considerably. And actually, we're getting to the point where they're due another bump.
Times with the stadium.
Yeah, and I think in a similar period to Levy, there are a lot of key players that would have gone up by 50 or 60%.
Mm. And interestingly, he's got a manager in place who can get...
Who will also go up if he signs a new contract by 50%.
But also he's got a manager in place who actually doesn't seem to need these players to... If they're holding us over a barrel, which I don't think they are. I think Tobin and Danny Rose as well in the summer raised similar concerns. Mm. I think they've voiced their opinion. We've basically binned Rose all season. Toby's been gone since probably December. I don't think he's really played all that much apart from the FK. Injuries aside, you know, by now he should be part of the fully integrated into the squad, you'd think. And we're still kind of charging on without him, aren't we?
That's the thing. None of those guys have ended up negotiating from a position of strength. And it's not necessarily suggesting that's been a conscious response to them stepping out and going, I'm not happy. But even someone like Kyle Walker, who... You know, came out and he is now earning an awful lot more than he was at Spurs, but Spurs haven't missed him. You know, he's doing really well at City, but I mean, in terms of on the pitch, you know, it hasn't inhibited their ability to beat big teams, to be a top four
team. I'd argue Spurs
they haven't taken
him,
a big step back.
Yeah,
equally, Walker's not the difference between City winning the title and Spurs not, is he?
No,
really.
No.
So,
but yeah. I mean, especially with Guardiola's style, I think City have gained more than Spurs have lost. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. I mean, Toby and Rose would still be sold for 40, 50 million apiece. Well, let's say between 70 and 80 million between them anyway. So it's just... And that's Levy, isn't it? That's Levy's style. Yeah, and all right, you look at weakening the squad, but with a manager like Pochettino in place, it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't really feel like that's a realistic possibility in it. But we'll see. I think... I was going to talk about Sanchez, but I don't think we need to say any more on that. I don't think he was
very
exceptional
good.
Against Chelsea,
yeah.
Isn't he, as well.
Looked very good.
Stoke away on Saturday feels like a bit of a. You mentioned about at the start of February we had this horrendous run that we were pointing at, and I know in the middle of that we've had like Bournemouth and stuff, but with Juventus in Champions League as well, it suddenly feels like Stoke and Brighton on the horizon feels a bit like ah, and that's the worst thing. That's the worst possible feeling to have, really. We're unbeaten in 13 in the league. Last defeat we had was Man City before Christmas. Stoke not won in 8, 3 points from safety. They've conceded 61 goals, 4 more than anyone else. Scored once in 4 games. We've beaten them 4-0 on the last 2 occasions at the Britannia or Bet365. We've just beaten Chelsea away for the first time in 3 decades. That 1-0 win for Stoke's going to be really annoying, isn't it? Shaqiri.
That's the old
minutes.
Spurs.
Yeah. No, it feels like this is another one where Kane coming back. And to finish on this question, Sam Sheard on Twitter, who are you dropping for Kane at the weekend? And also, how many will he score, seeing as Salah is running away with the golden boot? It's an interesting one, actually, because you've now got a kind of fired up Kane with... We've got a goal in mind, but Kane coming back is good regardless, but he's going to have something in his sights as well, isn't he?
So I reckon put money on Kane to win the Golden Boot
really?
Now while he can.
What's he? How
I still think Salah's the strong favourite. He's 5 behind.
Wow, yeah, that's Stoke. He could get 3.
But, I mean...
Wasn't he 4 behind Aguero?
He was short of Lukaku last season. He was 7 in the last 2 games.
Yeah. That's right.
So I really think while his odds are long, stick a fiver on.
And how many goals have Tottenham put past Stoke in the last couple of years?
It's
the first time.
Four, yeah.
The same opponent has beaten a team by 4 goals or more 4 consecutive games.
Wow, okay.
I think.
Yeah, that's right.
We beat them at Wembley
and we beat
5-1.
And then 4-0 at Stoke and 4-0 at home, at the last one at White Hart Lane, 4-0 before that, yeah.
And this might be the lowest Stoke ebb you've experienced.
Mm.
You
know, well, having said that, the reaction from their 3-0 defeat at Arsenal seemed to be actually quite positive.
But the way
insofar as they matched a poor Arsenal side for 75 odd minutes and then went down 1-0 to a very questionable penalty. Well, it wasn't a penalty. and then lost 3-0, admittedly. But so I don't think in the same way that Southampton seems to have lost all spirit, I don't think Stoke have quite given up yet. So I don't think it's a case of Spurs just turning up there and strolling past them. But I do think if Spurs can get an early first goal, as you said, Stoke collapsed after conceding. So
you look after Shaqiri and set pieces, you'll win.
Yeah, Shaqiri looked quite handy from what I saw of him at Arsenal.
But to answer Sam's question, Spurs scored 10 goals in the last 3 games. I think we've averaged a goal every 20 minutes without Kane. Is it a case of just taking out Lamela? I said it earlier about I'd rather see Lamela, you know, away at Chelsea than at home to, for example, a Stoke. Is that what you'd do? Come on.
The question is, are Tottenham better without Harry Kane?
Tom genuinely tried to suggest that a couple of pods ago.
I said the
oh, he didn't like that.
That's not what I said.
Well.
So you backed me into a corner and I acted. No, what I said was that it was teams will set up to, or they'll work all week on how to deal with Spurs with Harry Kane, and when he went off against Bournemouth, we suddenly kind of tore him to pieces because of the movement. You saw against Chelsea as well, the movement that we had until we settled on that kind of Eriksen deep, Lamela up top, Sol on the right, and Ali drifting everywhere. We were a little bit tepid, certainly in the first half, I think, apart from Eriksen's screamer. So I didn't quite say that.
No, I know. I'm winding up. But then it is Lamela, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Or Son.
It's
Lamela.
If
yeah,
you're winding up in the last 10 minutes, then yeah, by all means, bring on Lamela to basically kick Shaqiri.
To get one over Charlie Adam. Just to lay one on him.
That's true. Oh, I forgot about that.
Sacrifice himself for the rest of the season.
They've actually banished, Lambert's banished a couple of players from Stoke. Afolaya has been banned from training. And there's someone else as well. I can't remember who it was.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, they seem to be in... I mean, they're in big trouble. You look at the 3 teams that are going down this season. West Brom, it's happening. Stoke, it looked pretty bleak. And Southampton's not looking great as well. These quite sort of bogey teams for Spurs in a way.
I'm not going to lie, I wouldn't be unhappy with that.
No, not at all. Quite happy with the 3 teams that came up, staying up.
Yeah.
And those 3 going down.
Yeah.
Certainly West Brom. We've got West Brom, actually. I think we could relegate them mathematically. And technically we can relegate them. I might be wrong, I can't remember, but they're one of those teams that we've got left.
The story I read about an hour ago that's slightly concerning is that apparently Guardiola, this is completely off topic by the way, Guardiola wants to rest players against United if the Liverpool tie is still in the balance and go for the league at Wembley, which I don't think is what Spurs wanted to.
Oh, that's annoying. Yeah.
Well, no, rest players with a view to I don't desperately want to win at Old Trafford.
Yeah, that sends a bigger message, doesn't it, to United in a way. You mean so little to us now that we can rest for our Champions League.
I see that.
Crazy, isn't it?
But I think every Spurs fan was just kind of hoping it was done by then, and that City have still got so many records to go for, so it would never have been a kind of City with an eye off the ball. And they've still got to maintain form in the Champions League. But I think everyone hoped that it was a kind of City who had wrapped it up.
It's not really an issue now after the Stamford Bridge win. You're basically talking third or fourth. And don't the Premier League get 4 guaranteed Champions League spots now?
Yeah, that's very true. But
so,
I mean, I think
it doesn't make too much tangible difference, I don't think. If you'd have lost at Stamford Bridge, then yeah, that would be a big thing.
And suddenly Stoke becomes more important. Yeah. Then if we don't win there,
yeah, this is Tottenham we're talking about. It could still go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair though, what we've got left, we've got Stoke away, we've got City at home, and then after that we've got Newcastle to be rearranged, Brighton away, Leicester at home, West Brom away, and Watford at home. I mean, you're looking at, we need 13 points to guarantee top 4. And I don't know what a win, because Liverpool are a game ahead of us at the moment. I don't know what a win puts us behind them. Maybe 2 points. But
no,
Liverpool,
ahead of them. We're going.
Does it really?
Yeah, we'll be ahead of Liverpool.
And Liverpool's still got Chelsea, haven't they? I mean,
the second to last game.
Okay. I mean, by then, obviously, things could be done and dusted. But there's still plenty to play for. But you imagine 13 points from those 7 games is more than achievable before we even hit Leicester last game of the season. So, but we'll see. could be sitting here talking about cup final loss in fifth place. No, I'm sure we won't. I'm sure we won't. Liam, thank you very much for coming on. I hope we were magnanimous enough. Who knows? You could actually be on here again.
Cup final. Pod.
Yeah, before the end of the season.
Let's see a preview.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, it would be. Maybe we'd do a week of previews or something like that. But yeah, we've all got jobs, so. Dan, good to see you, mate.
And you, mate.
We'll be back next week with a Stoke review and a preview of Man City. Thank you very much for joining us.
Sorry, do you want to know who the most famous person to tweet me is?
Oh, go on.